although you come from a radical background yourself, how people in your union have reacted to the use of direct action?
I think it's been a real range of response. We've worked with folks who are members in foreclosure. So there are folks who have been directly involved in these fights, either as neighbors or as folks in foreclosure themselves. And there have been folks who are really excited and very supportive and very engaged in the direct action pieces. So we had 50 community and union members go and participate in the shareholder Wells Fargo direct action this past spring, and people were extremely excited. We had members who did a day of statewide action where they did bank actions in, I think, 12 different towns and cities across the state on the same day. So there's some folks who are extremely excited about it. And then there are definitely folks who are skeptical or just like, this is an awful idea. This is not the way we've done stuff. But I think that the other thing that's happening within the union is realizing that the way that they've maybe been used to doing stuff isn't working, even in their own work sites and even in their own contract negotiations. And so there's more and more interest in how do we use these tactics and these ways of thinking about taking action as part of how we fight on a day-to-day basis in our workplace. And so we were asked both by union members and actually community folks who were really interested in some of the relationship building work that we were doing and how maybe they felt really comfortable taking direct action but hadn't really thought that much about the base building pieces of neighborhood conversations and building and maintaining those long-term relationships that it's taken. And so we put together a guide, a sort of little workbook called the Economic Emergency Toolkit, that's just sharing, you know, how are we approaching this, the types of conversations and relationship building we're doing, how are we approaching taking direct action, and also how are we thinking about strategy and long-term planning for not just taking action one day, but over a period of time in escalating ways. And with that toolkit, we've started to do trainings around Portland and around the state with community members and members of the union, talking about how could direct action relate to the problem solving, not just on foreclosure or on the things that we're directly working on, but in your life and in your community and in your work sites. And we have more of those planned to work with members on this stuff who are mostly really intrigued and really interested, but maybe not confident direct action doers yet.
Sure. Now, as you've described during this hour, the people who are involved in this campaign come from very different walks of life. You mentioned Occupy activists, you've mentioned homeowners in certain neighborhoods in Portland, different people on the left who are allies. What have been the challenges of bringing all these different people together within this entity?
I think it's the challenges. It feels like some of the same challenges that it takes to unite a worksite, but on a really big scale. getting people to work together and start to build trust, to in some cases put aside maybe having ideological arguments with each other for a moment and focusing on what's the common goal that we actually share together and how could we be more powerful together. And I think for some of the folks we've been working with, there's a couple of homeowners, one in particular that comes to mind that actually was a really right-wing person when we started working with them. Very, very religious, very right-wing in their politics. And over the course of just working with a wide variety of people and realizing, for example, that, oh, those Occupy folks, those are the people who came to my house and who said that they were going to stand with me on my front lawn against the sheriff. Those, like, seeing how the just real work together, the way that people have come out and supported each other, has been a powerful way of uniting people and seeing that it's possible to work together and to actually have success when you do that. but it's still an ongoing and challenging thing. I think it can get really challenging, everything from the culture of meetings being really different depending on whether you are primarily coming from a working class neighborhood versus coming from maybe an established left background. Culture of meetings very different, and that can get divisive and alienating. Trying to work through differences in ideology, not becoming a barrier to actually doing the things that everyone agrees they want to fight for. And I think that's an ongoing and always challenging process.
And what are the challenges in an approach which seeks to get people to take action and take agency, if I can use such a clunky term, in their own lives rather than expecting organizers to come in and sort of do the work for them, point them in the right direction, and kind of take over?
It's a really hard balance, I think, of being supportive and helping provide some structure and some know-how without just doing everything or making all the decisions. And I'm sure there's probably a whole spectrum of critique, how successful and one way or the other have we been about that. Are we, do we make too many decisions for people who are paid organizers or not? But I think one of the delicate balances has been particularly around making sure that families who are taking on this fight really directly, going public, being in a high-risk situation, and the folks who come out to support them, the rapid responders who sign up and say, I'm going to come out to their house, that we really provide a lot of agency to make sure they know the situation they're walking into. They know they have a way of making a solid plan that they're a part of, and that the decisions along the way, each time, even as things are unfolding, for example, on someone's lawn, we're constantly checking in with the family and saying, okay, this is where the situation is. Here's some of the choices that you could make right now. And those choices, here's what we think would happen with these choices. What do you think about that? What do you want to do? And that's been really key for having people feel like I'm not being asked to do things things aren't going in a direction that I'm uncomfortable with, but that I'm choosing along the way about where I want this to go. But it's also been really helpful as far as being able to have a coherent, consistent plan, in that each time we work on this stuff, homeowners get back together and they say, here's what worked, here's what didn't. We get feedback from the people who've come out to actions. Here's what we feel worked, here's what didn't. And so that process has also really helped shape how things like the Rapid Response Network develop and change in its capacity, and how we think about the plan that we work with people on when they're thinking about, I want to resist at my house. So it's been sort of an ongoing and evolving process about how do we create as much agency as possible and balance bringing skill and support and experience. And not just saying, well, whatever, which I also think is unhelpful if people just say, well, we can do whatever. We haven't found that to work. We tried that, actually, of having people just show up and then we decide there how to react, and it didn't really work. We actually needed to have a plan in advance. We've tried a lot of different models along the way as well of how to make decisions until we figured out where should agency lie to be the most responsive and participatory.
Well, let me just end by asking you what the other campaigns that We Are Oregon has been working on and how you assess the successes of those campaigns so far.
We've been working a lot with folks who are experiencing wage theft. Their employer doesn't pay them all the money they're owed. And those have been really successful, actually. So far, we have not lost a wage theft fight. We've done two or three a month, I would say, since June, and won quite a bit of money back for workers, but more importantly, started to build a really strong worker committee that they helped plan and develop actions and responses with the other folks who are experiencing wage theft. We have been working with a group of youth in Rockwood around having a voice in their community, and they did a self-directed art project and have been doing displays of that art around the city, managed to get space in City Hall to show their work and talk about what it means to live in Rockwood, which is a an area that's really poor and has been really overlooked by the city. And we also have been doing a lot of work around what we've been calling intentional solidarity, the idea that you go and support working class struggles without necessarily an ask in return. It's trying to get away from the idea of this sort of transactional, well, that union or that group is my friend and they give me this, so I come to their action, versus that group is in a struggle and they have a plan to try to win that struggle that needs more capacity and support, and therefore we should contribute to that, whether we have an ask in return. And so we've been doing things like we participated in the port shutdown last December, and we bottom-lined the Longview port work along with the Occupy folks up there, as well as supporting Walmart workers who are organizing and local organizing drives here in Portland, and doing a whole bunch of things, sometimes direct action, sometimes just aid and support for the teacher strike as well.
Well, Angela McWhinney, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a pleasure having you on.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you.
I've been speaking with union organizer Angela McWhinney. She works with We Are Oregon.
And if you'd like to hear more shows in that vein, you can download them from againstthegrain.org. I found that a very interesting note on which to end, the conscious shift towards a gift economy. For me, this is intimately connected to resisting the power of money, money which uses people's self-interest, which justifies and normalizes selfish interest, to organize people into hierarchies which can be directed from the top, where the money is created. Well, this doesn't work if people are self-sufficient, if they're wise to that scheme, and they have the courage to say no to the man, say, I don't want your money if it comes with jobs that I don't want to do. Who has that courage as an individual? Difficult. If you're a large group, then how are they going to repossess the house? Now, we've all been drilled in Western society the idea that we have to have incentives, we have to have markets, because otherwise who would build any more houses? Well, do we need any more houses built? Do we need a tiny fraction of the consumer goods which are made? Well, huge amounts of resources are spent to persuade people that they need them, which would suggest to me that perhaps we don't need them. Do we actually need the system of rents and mortgages, the system of moving resources from the poor to the rich, or from the poor countries, so-called, to the rich countries, so-called? Whose interest does it actually serve? If these countries are functioning democracies, you might think that it would serve the interests of more than 50% of the population. I think a closer examination will find it serves the material short-term interests of maybe less than 1%. And in the long term, I don't think it's going to work. I think we're approaching one of those singularities, the year of Jubilee, as David Graeber noted, which have happened throughout history, in which the debt tablets get broken and people start afresh. Now let's return to Thoreau's Walden, which includes some remarkably parallel thoughts, considering it's a century and a half ago.
But if they should feel the influence of the spring of springs arousing them, they would of necessity rise to a higher and more ethereal life. I had previously seen the snakes in frosty mornings in my path, with portions of their bodies still numb and inflexible, waiting for the sun to thaw them. On the 1st of April, it rained and melted the ice, and in the early part of the day, which was very foggy, I heard a stray goose groping about over the pond and cackling as if lost, or like the spirit of the fog. So I went on for some days, cutting and hewing timber, and also studs and rafters, all with my narrow axe, not having many communicable or scholar-like thoughts, singing to myself, "Men say they know many things, but lo, they have taken wings. The arts and sciences, and a thousand appliances, the wind that blows, is all that anybody knows." I hewed the main timbers 6 inches square, most of the studs on two sides only, and the rafters and floor timbers on one side, leaving the rest of the bark on, so that they were just as straight and much stronger than the sawed ones. Each stick was carefully mortised, or tenoned, by its stump, for I had borrowed other tools by this time. My days in the woods were not very long ones, yet I usually carried my dinner of bread and butter, and read the newspaper in which it was wrapped, at noon, sitting amid the green pine boughs which I had cut off, and to my bread was imparted some of their fragrance, for my hands were covered with a thick coat of pitch. Before I had done, I was more the friend than the foe of the pine tree, though I had cut down some of them, having become better acquainted with it. Sometimes a rambler in the wood was attracted by the sound of my axe, and we chatted pleasantly over the chips which I had made. By the middle of April, for I made no haste in my work, but rather made the most of it, my house was framed and ready for the raising. I had already bought the shanty of James Collins, an Irishman who worked on the Fitchburg Railroad, for boards. James Collins' shanty was considered an uncommonly fine one. When I called to see it, he was not at home. I walked about the outside, at first unobserved from within. The windows were so deep and high. It was of small dimensions, with a peaked cottage roof, and not much else to be seen, the dirt being raised 5 feet all around, as if it were a compost heap. The roof was the soundest part, though a good deal warped and made brittle by the sun. Doorsill? There was none, but a perennial passage for the hens under the doorboard. Mrs. C. came to the door and asked me to view it from the inside. The hens were driven in by my approach. It was dark, and had a dirt floor, for the most part. Dank, clammy, and aguish, only here a board and there a board which would not bear removal. She lighted a lamp to show me the inside of the roof and the walls, and also that the board floor extended under the bed, warning me not to step into the cellar, a sort of dust-hole 2 feet deep. In her own words, they were good boards overhead, good boards all around, and a good window. Of 2 whole squares originally, only the cat had passed out that way lately. There was a stove, a bed, and a place to sit. An infant in the house where it was born, a silk parasol, gilt-framed looking-glass, and a patent new coffee-mill nailed to an oak sapling, all told. The bargain was soon concluded, for James had in the meantime returned. I to pay $4.25 tonight, he to vacate at 5 tomorrow morning, selling to nobody else meanwhile. I to take possession at 6. It were well, he said, to be there early, and anticipate certain indistinct but wholly unjust claims on the score of ground rent and fuel. This, he assured me, was the only encumbrance. At 6 I passed him and his family on the road, One large bundle held their all: bed, coffee mill, looking glass, hens. All but the cat. She took to the woods and became a wild cat. And, as I learned afterward, trod in a trap set for woodchucks, and so became a dead cat at last. I took down this dwelling the same morning, drawing the nails, and removed it to the pond side by small cartloads, spreading the boards on the grass there to bleach and warp back again in the sun. One early thrush gave me a note or two as I drove along the woodland path. I was informed treacherously by a young Patrick that neighbor Seely, an Irishman, in the intervals of the carting, transferred the still tolerable, straight, and drivable nails, staples, and spikes to his pocket, and then stood when I came back to pass the time of day and look freshly up, unconcerned with spring thoughts at the devastation, there being a dearth of work, as he said. He was there to represent spectatordom and help make this seemingly insignificant event one with the removal of the gods of Troy. I dug my cellar in the side of a hill sloping to the south, where a woodchuck had formerly dug his burrow, down through sumac and blackberry roots, and the lowest stain of vegetation, 6 feet square by 7 deep, to a fine sand where potatoes would not freeze in any winter. The sides were left shelving and not stoned, but the sun having never shone on them, the sand still keeps its place. It was but 2 hours' work. I took particular pleasure in this breaking of ground, for in almost all latitudes men dig into the earth for an equable temperature. Under the most splendid house in the city is still to be found the cellar, where they store their roots as of old, and long after the superstructure has disappeared, posterity remark its dent in the earth. The house is still but a sort of porch at the entrance of a burrow. At length, in the beginning of May, with the help of some of my acquaintances, rather to improve so good an occasion for neighborliness than from any necessity, I set up the frame of my house. No man was ever more honored in the character of his raisers than I. They are destined, I trust, to assist at the raising of loftier structures one day. I began to occupy my house on the 4th of July, as soon as it was boarded and roofed, for the boards were carefully feather-edged and lapped, so that it was perfectly impervious to rain. But before boarding I laid the foundation of a chimney at one end, bringing 2 cartloads of stones up the hill from the pond in my arms. I built the chimney, after my hoeing in the fall, before a fire became necessary for warmth, doing my cooking in the meanwhile out of doors on the ground, early in the morning, which mode I still think is in some respects more convenient and agreeable than the usual one. When it stormed before my bread was baked, I fixed a few boards over the fire and sat under them to watch my loaf, and passed some pleasant hours in that way. In those days when my hands were much employed, I read but little, but the least scraps of paper which lay on the ground, my holder or tablecloth, afforded me as much entertainment, in fact, answered the same purpose as the Iliad. It would be worth the while to build still more deliberately than I did, considering, for instance, what foundation a door, a window, a cellar, a garret, have in the nature of man, and perchance never raising any superstructure until we found a better reason for it than our temporal necessities even. There is some of the same fitness in a man's building his own house that there is in a bird's building its own nest. Who knows but if men constructed their dwellings with their own hands and provided food for themselves and families simply and honestly enough, the poetic faculty would be universally developed, as birds universally sing when they are so engaged. But alas, we do like cowbirds and cuckoos, which lay their eggs in nests which other birds have built, and cheer no traveller with their chattering and unmusical notes. Shall we forever resign the pleasure of construction to the carpenter? What does architecture amount to in the experience of the mass of men? I never in all my walks came across a man engaged in so simple and natural an occupation as building his house. We belong to the community. It is not the tailor alone who is the ninth part of a man. It is as much the preacher and the merchant and the farmer. Where is this division of labor to end? And what object does it finally serve? No doubt another may also think for me, but it is not therefore desirable that he should do so to the exclusion of my thinking for myself. True, there are architects so called in this country, and I have heard of one at least possessed with the idea of making architectural ornaments have a core of truth, a necessity, and hence a beauty, as if it were a revelation to him. All very well, perhaps, from his point of view, but only a little better than the common dilettantism. A sentimental reformer in architecture, he began at the cornice, not at the foundation. It was only how to put a core of truth within the ornaments, that every sugar plum, in fact, might have an almond or caraway seed in it, though I hold that almonds are most wholesome without the sugar, and not how the inhabitant, the indweller, might build truly within and without, and let the ornaments take care of themselves. What reasonable man ever supposed that ornaments were something outward and in the skin merely? That the tortoise got his spotted shell, or the shellfish its mother-o'-pearl tints, by such a contract as the inhabitants of Broadway, their Trinity Church. But a man has no more to do with the style of architecture of his house than a tortoise with that of its shell. Nor need the soldier be so idle as to try to paint the precise color of his virtue on his standard. The enemy will find it out. He may turn pale when the trial comes. This man seemed to me to lean over the cornice and timidly whisper his half-truth to the rude occupants, who really knew it better than he. What of architectural beauty I now see, I know has gradually grown from within outward, out of the necessities and character of the indweller, who is the only builder, out of some unconscious truthfulness and nobleness, without ever a thought for the appearance, and what additional beauty of this kind is destined to be produced will be preceded by a like unconscious beauty of life. The most interesting dwellings in this country, as the painter knows, are the most unpretending, humble log huts and cottages of the poor, commonly. It is the life of the inhabitants whose shells they are, and not any peculiarity in their surfaces merely which make them picturesque. And equally interesting will be the citizen's suburban box, when his life shall be as simple and as agreeable to the imagination, and there is as little straining after effect in the style of his dwelling. A great proportion of architectural ornaments are literally hollow, and a September gale would strip them off like borrowed plumes, without injury to the substantials. They can do without architecture, who have no olives nor wines in the cellar. What if an equal ado were made about the ornaments of style in literature, and the architects of our Bibles spent as much time about their cornices as the architects of our churches do? So are made the belles lettres and the beaux-arts, and their professors. Much it concerns a man, forsooth, how a few sticks are slanted over him or under him, and what colours are daubed upon his box. It would signify somewhat if, in any earnest sense, he slanted them and daubed it. But the spirit having departed out of the tenant, it is of a piece with constructing his own coffin, the architecture of the grave. And carpenter is but another name for coffin-maker. One man says, in his despair or indifference to life, take up a handful of the earth at your feet and paint your house that color. Is he thinking of his last and narrow house? Toss up a copper for it as well. What an abundance of leisure he must have! Why do you take up a handful of dirt? Better paint your house your own complexion. Let it turn pale or blush for you. An enterprise to improve the style of cottage architecture. When you have got my ornaments ready, I will wear them. Before winter I built a chimney, and shingled the sides of my house, which were already impervious to rain, with imperfect and sappy shingles made of the first slice of the log, whose edges I was obliged to straighten with a plane. I have thus a tight shingled and plastered house, 10 feet wide by 15 long, and 8 feet posts, with a garret and a closet, a large window on each side, 2 trap-doors, 1 door at the end, and a brick fireplace opposite. The exact cost of my house, paying the usual price for such materials as I used, but not counting the work, all of which was done by myself, was as follows, and I give the details because very few are able to tell exactly what their houses cost, and fewer still, if any, the separate cost of the various materials which compose them. Boards, $8.03 plus, mostly shanty boards. Refuse shingles for roof sides, $4. Laths, $1.25. 2 second-hand windows with glass, $2.43. 1,000 old brick, $4. 2 casks of lime, $2.40. That was high. Hair, 31 cents. More than I needed. Mantel tree iron, 15 cents. Nails, $3.90. Hinges and screws, 14 cents. Latch, 10 cents. Chalk, 1 cent. Transportation, $1.40. I carried a good part on my back. In all, $28.12 plus. These are all the materials, excepting the timber, stones, and sand which I claimed by squatter's right. I have also a small woodshed adjoining, made chiefly of the stuff which was left after building the house. I intend to build me a house which will surpass any on the main street in Concord in grandeur and luxury, as soon as it pleases me as much, and will cost me no more than my present one. I thus found that the student who wishes for a shelter can obtain one for a lifetime at an expense not greater than the rent which he now pays annually. If I seem to boast more than is becoming, my excuse is that I brag for humanity rather than for myself, and my shortcomings and inconsistencies do not affect the truth of my statement. Notwithstanding much cant and hypocrisy, chaff which I find it difficult to separate from my wheat, but for which I am as sorry as any man, I will breathe freely and stretch myself in this respect. It is such a relief to both the moral and physical system, and I am resolved that I will not, through humility, become the devil's attorney. I will endeavor to speak a good word for the truth. At Cambridge College, the mere rent of a student's room, which is only a little larger than my own, is $30 each year, though the corporation had the advantage of building 32 side by side and under one roof, and the occupant suffers the inconvenience of many and noisy neighbors, and perhaps a residence in the fourth story. I cannot but think that if we had more true wisdom in these respects, not only less education would be needed, because forsooth more would already have been acquired, but the pecuniary expense of getting an education would in a great measure vanish.
And education, the prime example, one of those things that people are convinced they need to spend money on. Their children have to be sent to particular places to memorize particular things, to get bits of paper, to get jobs. This is written in the 19th century, middle of, when living on your own land, doing your own thing, was not such a revolutionary thought. It was part of what American life was about. We've had a century and a half of institutionalization, systematization piled on top of that, and the man who more than any other has helped me to get to the bottom of that has been, of course, John Taylor Gatto. So I thought it appropriate. Now we hear a section from chapter 10 of The Underground History of American Education. Now, unless you've downloaded the audio book, you won't have heard this before, because Lynn skipped this chapter. This is the conclusion of a chapter called My Green River, and this reading begins with John Taylor Gatto talking about his grandfather. So we're not that far off the time when Thoreau was writing about, this is before school was made mandatory all over the US, and it's a time worthy of study, I think, to help us imagine what more ethereal life he may be heading towards would look like. We're back in Monongahela now, a town of strong principles, even if some are wacky or plain wrong. Pragmatism is a secondary theme here, scorned by most unless it keeps to its place, a bittersweet oddity because practicality is the town's lingua franca. The phenomenon of open scorn for the lower orders isn't seen in my valley, never to the degree I experienced it later in Ithaca, Cambridge, and Manhattan. The oppressed are insufficiently docile in Monongahela for anyone to revile openly. So the Pinkerton detectives found out when they went there to do Andrew Carnegie's dirty work at Homestead during the steel strike of 1893. There is only one restaurant in the town proper, Peter's. It's a place where the country club set drinks coffee alongside rubber jockeys from the tire vulcanizing shop across the street. Several nights a week, long after dark, when house lights were blazing, Mother would gather Sister and me for long, quiet walks up Second Street Hill to the very top, then along the streets, on the ridge line parallel to the river. From these excursions and from morning walks on River Hill, I learned to listen to my senses and see that town as a creature in itself, instead of a background for my activity. We would walk this way for hours, whispering to each other, looking in windows, and as we walked, Booty would deliver an only partially intelligible stream of biographical lore about the families within. I realize now
She must have been talking to herself. It was like having a private Boswell to the Dr. Johnson of town society. When she had some money, which was now and then, we would buy candy at the little grocery at the top of the hill and share it together, sometimes two candy bars for the three of us, or in flush times a whole candy bar each, and in the weeks following Christmas, when there was holiday money, two each. On two candy nights the atmosphere seemed so filled with chocolate perfume that I could hardly sleep. When my granddad was a boy in Monongahela, he watched John Blythe, a planing mill operator, rebuild large sections of the town in the Italianate style. Blythe had no degree, and the religion of professional licensing was still in infancy. So he just did it without asking anyone's permission. Whole sections of the town are now handsome beyond any reasonable right to be, because nobody stopped him. If you see a keystone over a window moulding, it's likely to be one of John's. When my granddad was a boy in Monongahela, he used to sit in Mounds Park, site of two ancient burial mounds left there by the Adena people 3,000 years ago. In 1886, the Smithsonian robbed these graves and took the contents to Washington, where they still sit in crates. To compensate the town, the government built a baseball field where the mounds had been. When my granddad was a boy, school was voluntary. Some went, but most not for long. It was a free will choice based on what you valued, not a government hustle to stabilize social classes. The most important studies I ever engaged in weren't at Cornell or Columbia, but in the windowless basement of the Zimmer Printing Company, a block and a half from the railroad tracks that ran alongside the Monongahela. Some of my greatest lessons unfolded near the mysterious dark green river, with its thick ice sheet near the banks in winter, its iridescent dragonflies in summer, and its always breathtaking stern-wheelers pounding the water up and down, bam, 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 on the way to ports unknown. To me, the river was without beginning or end. Before he went to Germany to beat up the Nazis, my warrior uncle Bud worked on a riverboat that went down the Mississippi to New Orleans. On what mission, I can't say. Then on other boats that went up and down smaller local rivers. When I was five, he once threw an orange at me from a riverboat gallery while it passed through a lock. A right fielder's strong throwing arm sent that orange 200 feet out of the watery trench into my hands. I didn't even have to move. In the basement of the printing office, Bud's father, the General, as Moss called him behind his back, moved strong hands on and off a printing press. Those presses are gone, but my grandfather's hands will never be gone. They remain on my shoulder as I write this. I would sit on the steps into his subterranean world, watching closely hour after hour as those rough hands fed sheets of paper into the steam-driven clamshell press. It went bam, feed, bam, feed, bam, feed, like the riverboats. And bit by bit, the job piled up on the table next to the press. It was a classroom without bells or tests. I never got bored, never got out of line. In school I was thrown out of class frequently for troublemaking, but Pappy wouldn't stand for nonsense, not a scrap of it. He was all purpose. I never saw a man concentrate as he did, as long as it took, whatever was called for. I transferred that model unconsciously to my teaching. While my colleagues were ruled by start-up times, bell schedules, lunch hour, loudspeaker announcements, and dismissal, I was oblivious to these interruptions. I was ruled by the job to be done, kid by kid, until it was over. Whatever that meant, kid by kid. No baseball or football, no fishing, no shopping, no romantic adventure could possibly have matched the fascination I felt watching that tough old man in his tough old town work his hand-fed press in a naked, light, bulb-lit cellar without any supervisor to tell him what to do or how to feel about it. He knew how to design and do layout, set type, buy paper, ink presses and repair them, clean up, negotiate with customers, price jobs, and keep the whole ensemble running. How did he learn this without school? Harry Taylor Zimmer, Sr. I loved him. still do. He worked as naturally as he breathed, a perfect hero to me. I wonder if he understood that. On some secret level, it was Pappy who held our family together, regardless of his position as pariah to his wife and his estranged brothers, regardless of an ambivalent relationship of few words with his daughter and son, granddaughter and grandson, and with his remaining brother, Will, the only one who still spoke to him and worked alongside him at the presses. I say spoke, when the best I can personally attest to is only association. They worked side by side, but I never actually heard a single conversation between them. Will never entered our apartment above the shop. He slept on the press table in the basement. Yet Pappy kept the family faith. He knew his duty. When Bud brought his elegant wife home from the war, she would sit in Pappy's room talking to him hour after hour, the two snorting and laughing thick as thieves. He had lost the key of conversation only with his own bloodline. I realize today that if Pappy couldn't count on himself, he was out of business and the rest of us in the poorhouse. If he hadn't liked himself, he would have gone crazy, alone with those heavy metal rhythms in the eternal gloom of the printing office basement. As I watched him, he never said a word, didn't throw a glance in my direction. I had to supply my own incentive. Welcome to stay or go, yet I sensed he appreciated my presence. Perhaps he did understand how I loved him. Sometimes, when the job was finished, he would lecture me a little about politics I didn't understand. In the craft tradition, printers are independent, even dangerous men. Ben Franklin was a printer, like my German grandfather, himself preoccupied with things German at times. Movable type itself is German. Pappy was a serious student of the Prussian philosopher Hegel. I would hear Hegel's name in his conversations with Bud's wife, Helen. Late in his own life, he began to speak to my father again, and sometimes even to me, in my middle teens. I remember references to Hegel from those times, too. Hegel was philosopher in residence at the University of Berlin during the years when Prussia was committing itself to forced schooling. It's not far-fetched to regard Hegel as the most influential thinker in modern history. Virtually everyone who has made political footprints in the past two centuries, school people included, was Hegelian or anti-Hegelian. Even today, many knowledgeable people have no idea how important Hegel is to the deliberations of important men as they debate our common future. Hegel was important wherever strict social control was an issue. Ambitious states couldn't let a single child escape, said Hegel. Hegel believed nothing happened by accident. He thought history was headed somewhere, and that its direction could be controlled. Men as gods was Hegel's theme, before it was H.G. Wells's. Hegel believed when battle cannon roared, it was God talking to himself, working out his own nature dialectically. It's a formidable concept. No wonder it appealed to men who didn't labour, like Mr. Morgan or Mr. Rockefeller or Mr. Carnegie, yet who still disdained easeful luxury. It engaged a printer's attention, and a little boy's, too. When I began to teach, I took the lessons of Monongahela and my two families to heart. The harder I struggled to understand myself, the better luck I had with other people's kids. A person has to know where his dead are buried, and what his duty is, before you can trust him. Whatever I had to teach children is locked up in the words you just read, as is the genesis of my critique of forced schooling.
I cannot but think that if we had more true wisdom in these respects, not only less education would be needed, because forsooth more would already have been acquired, but the pecuniary expense of getting an education would in a great measure vanish. Those conveniences which the student requires at Cambridge or elsewhere cost him, or somebody else, 10 times as great a sacrifice of life as they would with proper management on both sides. Those things for which the most money is demanded are never the things which the student most wants. tuition, for instance, is an important item in the term bill, while for the far more valuable education which he gets by associating with the most cultivated of his contemporaries, no charge is made. The mode of founding a college is, commonly, to get up a subscription of dollars and cents, and then, following blindly the principles of a division of labor to its extreme, a principle which should never be followed but with circumspection, to call in a contractor who makes this a subject of speculation, and he employs Irishmen, or other operatives, actually, to lay the foundations, while the students that are to be are said to be fitting themselves for it, and for these oversights successive generations have to pay. I think that it would be better than this for the students, or those who desire to be benefited by it, even to lay the foundation themselves. The student who secures his coveted leisure and retirement by systematically shirking any labor necessary to man obtains but an ignoble and unprofitable leisure, defrauding himself of the experience which alone can make leisure fruitful. But, says one, you do not mean that the students should go to work with their hands instead of their heads? I do not mean that exactly, but I mean something which he might think a good deal like that. I mean that they should not play life, or study it merely, while the community supports them at this expensive game, but earnestly live it from beginning to end. How could youths better learn to live than by at once trying the experiment of living? Methinks this would exercise their minds as much as mathematics. If I wished a boy to know something about the arts and sciences, for instance, I would not pursue the common course, which is merely to send him into the neighborhood of some professor, where anything is professed and practiced but the art of life, to survey the world through a telescope or a microscope, and never with his natural eye, to study chemistry, and not learn how his bread is made, or mechanics, and not learn how it is earned, to discover new satellites to Neptune, and not detect the motes in his eyes, or to what vagabond he is a satellite himself, or to be devoured by the monsters that swarm all around him, while contemplating the monsters in a drop of vinegar. Which would have advanced the most at the end of a month? The boy who had made his own jackknife from the ore which he had dug and smelted, reading as much as would be necessary for this, or the boy who had attended the lectures on metallurgy at the Institute in the meanwhile and had received a Rogers penknife from his father? Which would be most likely to cut his fingers? To my astonishment, I was informed on leaving college that I had studied navigation. Why, if I had taken one turn down the harbor, I should have known more about it. Even the poor student studies and is taught only political economy, while that economy of living, which is synonymous with philosophy, is not even sincerely professed in our colleges. The consequence is that while he is reading Adam Smith, Ricardo, and Say, he runs his father in debt irretrievably.
So, there's nothing new about student debt, apparently. Which brings us back to the ever-present question of money. So, there's just time for one more question from Suelo's FAQ. This is question 24. Your ideas sound nice, but naive. Let's get real. Don't you think, with all the thieves, the lazy, the moochers, and the greedy, that a moneyless, free economy just wouldn't work? Let me ask you this. Do you think the money system does away with thieves, moochers, the lazy, and the greedy? Have you considered that thieves, moochers, and lazy, and greedy people might just be a product of the money system? The greatest thieves, moochers, lazy, and greedy people are at the top of the money system. Bankers and stockbrokers and CEOs not only contribute little or nothing to society, but bleed the goods from the workers at the bottom. The very pattern of money society since ancient Sumer and Egypt has been for wealth to flow from the workers to the non-workers, from the industrious to the lazy. When you take more than you need, you're a thief. The very nature of the system of commerce is robbery and extortion. As with creatures in nature, the thieves, the mooches, the lazy, and the greedy people return to the natural balance, and if they don't, they're naturally selected out. Natural selection abhors thieves, and mooches, the lazy, and the greedy. Even the very force of people being accountable to each other in a tribal situation usually eliminates even the desire to steal or mooch or be lazy or greedy. You see it in animal societies, in hunting and gathering societies. We can see it in our own society beginning to happen on a temporary scale at rainbow gatherings. There are lots of moochers at rainbow gatherings. And so what is the prevailing idea? It's actually amazing how few thefts and what little violence there is at a rainbow gathering of 20,000 people, especially compared to a town of the same size. Towns of the same size which have police and locks and laws and lawyers have much more crime. Think about that. The rainbow gathering still miraculously works out due to the droves and droves of hard-working, generous people who don't give a hoot that someone else might be taking advantage. What is taking advantage? Philosophy is to do, expecting nothing in return, and that philosophy becomes infectious. There's a lot of riff-raff at gatherings, and a lot of true compassion that overshadows it. The idea of compassion is to have patience with thieves, moochers, the lazy, and the greedy, who are people who are still detoxing from being programmed by the money system. When you've been taught all your life that nothing is valuable unless you get money for it, you will initially be lazy, because you aren't paid. You haven't yet learned the true reward of doing itself and the reward of community with others, which makes money look ridiculous. When you've been programmed into thinking that possessing and not sharing are virtues, you tend to steal. And it takes you a while to be programmed from that. The Rainbow Gathering is a hospital, and those who caretake the hospital have a natural sense of patience with the patients, giving them all the time they need to heal. You can only be idle so long before you get sick of being idle and start wanting to contribute. It might take a while, but it happens naturally. Well, thanks to Gordon McKenzie for making that LibriVox recording of Wilden, which has helped me to make this episode freely available from unwelcomeguest.net/643, and all previous episodes are available for download on the website. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I hope this show has inspired you to think more about what a higher, ethereal life could be like, and to step towards it by stepping away from money.
We'll always be filled by unwelcome travelers and other